Among the responses to Burke was Tom Paine's The Rights of Man.
I am not contending for nor against any form of government, nor for nor against any party, here or elsewhere. That which a whole nation chooses to do, it has the right to do. Mr. Burke says no. Where, then, does the right exist? I am contending for the rights of the living, and against their being willed away, and controlled and contracted for by the manuscript-assumed authority of the dead. And Mr. Burke is contending for the authority of the dead over the rights of the living. Man did not enter into society to become worse than he was before, nor to have fewer rights than he had before, but to have those rights better secured. His natural rights are the foundation of all his civil rights.
Paine, born in Thetford in Norfolk, had sailed to America on the eve of the War of Independence. He had become an inspirational pamphleteer for the colonists during the war. The British government had no great cause to admire Paine, but what truly alarmed ministers and many others about the rights of man was who appeared to be reading it. In the winter of 1791-1792, societies had begun to be formed amongst ordinary working-class men calling for a reform of Parliament. While, to the surprise of foreign visitors, working men in London had long shown an interest in politics, it was something quite new for them to organise in political clubs and to demand political reform. The London Corresponding Society was the most famous, but there was a massive society organised among workers in the cutlery trade in Sheffield, and other societies sprang up among the weavers of East Anglia and amongst more general workers in Birmingham, Manchester, and other towns, big and small. It was these popular societies that sponsored cheap editions of Paine and purchased them in enormous numbers. Members of the societies also showed sympathy for the French, especially when, in the summer of 1792, the armies of Austria and Prussia appeared likely to destroy the revolution. French victories were cheered to the echo by the societies. Fraternal delegations visited the National Convention, and some British radicals began to adopt terms such as citizen, Jacobin, and even sans-culotte. The government responded by prosecuting Paine for sedition. He fled to France and was outlawed. The government also urged magistrates to prosecute anyone publishing Paine's work and similar materials. In the winter of 1792 through to 1793, even before the execution of Louis XVI and the French declaration of war, British loyalists were snooping into the political attitudes of those believed hostile to church and king, and government spies began to be infiltrated into the popular societies. 18th century wars had been fought between princes using small professional armies who sought to outmaneuver each other rather than confronting in a costly battle. The wars of the French Revolution were different. Ideology was involved. The French produced a mass citizen army, determined to bring its enemies to battle at every opportunity, and to destroy those enemies by revolutionary élan and sheer weight of numbers. Some in Britain did recognise that this was a new kind of war, and that ideology was important. Even so, many of the radicals still believed that they had a right to express their opinions, to criticise the war, and to urge reform in Britain. For loyalist supporters of church and king, such radicals appeared traitors, men who were aspiring to a Jacobin revolution in England. In the autumn of 1793, British radicals met in a national convention in Edinburgh, and the proceedings of the convention adopted many French forms. Given that the French National Convention had executed a king and queen and declared war on Britain, we might say that this was a foolhardy thing to do. The authorities closed the British convention, arrested the leadership, and following a succession of rather dodgy trials and verdicts, transported that leadership to New South Wales. Were British Jacobins plotting revolution? Well, it's possible that some were. Early in 1794, government spies were reporting extremist talk among some radicals in the political clubs, and papers seized by government agents questioned whether it should be policy to rip up monarchy by the roots. In the early summer, William Pitt's government took the bull by the horns, arrested radical leaders across the country, and suspended the Habeas Corpus Act with reference to such political suspects. Of those arrested in England, only three were brought to trial. All three were acquitted of high treason. Historians have debated whether a charge of conspiracy could have been made to stick. The treason charge was very complex, and it appears that the jurors were not keen to sentence anyone to the grisly traitor's death of hanging, drawing, and quartering. The arrests, the suspension of habeas corpus, and the trial proceedings seemed to have dulled the enthusiasm of the radicals. But the acquittals, the release of all those who had been arrested, and the economic situation of 1795 brought a resurgence of radical activity.